The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the May 11th, 2018 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows a smiling Bernie Sanders. He is standing in front of a display table that has a lot of shovels and hammers and hatchets, a lot of hand tools. And the banner in front of the display says, "The New Deal." Bernie is handing out shovels to a long line of working class folks. And the title is "Jobs for All: The Democrats' Proposal to Guarantee a Paycheck to Every American." And we'll get that on the controversy of the week, but we'll start with the main stories. This one titled, "Trump to Meet Kim at the DMZ. What happened?" President Trump expressed optimism that he can forge a peace deal with Kim Jong-un after the North Korean leader's historic summit with South Korean President Moon Jae-in last week. Trump announced this week that he wants his upcoming meeting with North Korean leader to take place in the demilitarized zone between the two countries, where Kim and Moon also met, so that there can be a great celebration on the site if the talks are a success. In a carefully choreographed ceremony in the border village of Panmunjom, Kim and Moon signed a declaration confirming their common goal of denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula and pledged to negotiate a peace treaty to formally end the 1950 to 1953 Korean War. Kim promised to dismantle his country's nuclear test site at Mount Montap in front of Western nuclear experts and journalists, though several reports suggested tests have already rendered the site unusable. After the summit, Trump triumphantly tweeted, "Korean War to End," all caps. The president praised China's role in facilitating the talks on Twitter, but told supporters at a rally in Michigan that he should get full credit for everything, a sentiment at least partially endorsed by Moon, who said Trump deserved the Nobel Peace Prize. National Security Advisor John Bolton insisted the administration wasn't starry-eyed about Kim's promises, asserting that the U.S. wouldn't ease sanctions or offer any other concessions until Pyongyang takes concrete steps toward dismantling its nuclear program. Trump's head-to-head with Kim is tentatively scheduled for late May or early June. What the editorial said: "Few people really believe Kim will give up his nuclear arsenal," said the San Francisco Chronicle. Having watched the violent regime change in Libya and Iraq after their leaders abandoned their nuclear programs, the North Korean dictator won't make the same mistake. He's probably hoping to wiggle out of some sanctions by making vague and unenforceable pledges to disarm. With Beijing and Seoul determined to lower the temperature on the peninsula, and Trump eager to be a historical peacemaker, Kim's strategy might just work. "It certainly has in the past," said NationalReview.com. Pyongyang pretended it would make major concessions during highly touted North-South summits in 1992, 2000, and 2007, only to renege on those promises after pocketing the economic benefits. Trump can stop history from repeating itself by insisting that Kim give up his nukes within months, walking away if he doesn't, and returning to a maximum pressure policy. No deal is better than a bad deal. What the columnist said: don't be taken in by Kim's sucker-born every-minute diplomacy, said Nicholas Eberstadt in the New York Times. North Korea's national identity is based on Juche, the doctrine that Koreans should be reunited in a socialist state under Pyongyang's control. Making peace with Seoul would mean abandoning the quest that has legitimized the Kim family's rule for three generations. Kim's nuclear weapons have forced China's Xi Jinping and President Trump to give him personal audiences, said David French in NationalReview.com. Without nukes, North Korea would be a ninth-rate nation with zero leverage over any nations besides South Korea. Denuclearization is not happening. The goals of Kim's full-on diplomatic offensive are not hard to discern, said Van Jackson in Politico.com. With his effusive shows of friendliness, the savvy Kim wants to persuade China, Russia, and the international community to accept North Korea as a peaceful nuclear state and stop participating in U.S. sanctions. So either Trump makes major concessions in his desperation for favorable news headlines, or Kim makes him look like the bad guy. Actually, a major diplomatic breakthrough may be possible if Trump can behave like a real-world leader, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. Moon and Kim agreed to a gradual process toward a peace treaty that would formally end the Korean War, with what Kim called phased, synchronized measures. North Korea may be willing to dismantle some of its nuclear arsenal as the U.S. lifts some of its sanctions in a step-by-step process of building trust. If Trump can overcome his impatience and accept this spirit of gradualism, he has a chance of success. If he demands total denuclearization right away, then the summit will be a disaster. And our controversy of the week: employment, the Democrats' job guarantee plan. Finally, said Jeff Spross in TheWeek.com, the Democrats may be getting their progressive groove back. In recent weeks, three of the party's likely presidential candidates, Senators Cory Booker, Kirsten Gillibrand, and Bernie Sanders, have endorsed a federal jobs guarantee, a bold idea that could make mass unemployment a thing of the past. Though details of each proposal vary, the basic concept is for the government to hire every American who wants a job and pay him or her $15 an hour with health care benefits. Under this program, economic recessions would come and go without accompanying waves of human misery. Full employment would exert upward pressure on private sector wages, especially at the low end. And though the cost would be high, $543 billion annually in one estimate, that would be offset by a tax increase on the wealthy and huge savings in Medicaid, unemployment, and welfare programs, which would have far fewer recipients. A jobs guarantee sounds radical, said Marie Solis in Newsweek.com, but it polls surprisingly well with voters, with 52% in favor and just 29% against, and is popular even in red states. As 2020 looms, this could be the big idea that helps Democrats win back those blue-collar voters who gave up on the party 2 years ago. This is a recipe for socialist disaster, said David Harsanyi in NationalReview.com. Guaranteed jobs would devastate small businesses, which would have to compete for workers with a government that can offer wages and benefits wholly untethered from the real cost of labor. More importantly, What would all of those people do? Said Megan McArdle on WashingtonPost.com. Franklin D. Roosevelt's Works Progress Administration was effective in its era, but today, roads, bridges, and buildings aren't built by armies of men wielding shovels. They're built by complex machinery you need extensive training to operate. While the government could put some people to work as home health care aides, painters, and clerks, it probably cannot use 25 million of them. Most of the people in this program would be doing expensive make work. Democrats' rapid embrace of a jobs guarantee is understandable, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. The party's invigorated left wants a major new piece of social engineering to mark a break from the neoliberal caution of the Clinton-Obama years. But Democrats need to be careful. The program would be enormously expensive in a time of rising deficits. A 5% income tax hike on those earning more than $200,000 would barely cover a fifth of the cost, according to one analysis. And guaranteeing every American a job presents a staggering bureaucratic challenge, including finding useful work that millions of unemployed people are qualified to do. Do you create jobs to match skills? It could be a huge mistake for Democrats to risk their electoral fortunes on a half-baked concept. The details don't matter yet, said Matthew Iglesias in Vox.com. As Democrats enter the next election cycle, a jobs guarantee sends a distinct message about the party's priorities and allegiances, and like President Trump's wall, should be taken seriously rather than literally. There is an unmissable whiff of socialism to the idea, said Jeffrey Dorfman in Forbes.com. But we conservatives have been saying for years that people should have to work for their government benefits. Federal jobs programs could make that linkage, even if the benefits are called wages. If it replaces free handouts with the need to work for a living, a jobs guarantee could be that rare liberal idea that conservatives end up embracing. It was a good week for being reborn, with news that the Swedish pop group ABBA has emerged from a 35-year retirement with new songs and plans for a digital world tour featuring four holographic avatars modeled on the 1979 version of the group. We thought we looked good that year, said Björn Ulvaeus, age 72. It was a good week for convoys, after 13 truck drivers positioned their 18-wheelers to make a de facto safety net beneath a man threatening to jump off a highway bridge near Detroit, thus saving his life. And it was a good week for doing it yourself, after a Tennessee woman, relying on YouTube how-to videos for guidance, delivered her own baby in a hotel room. I did a mighty fine job, if I do say so myself, said Tia Freeman, age 22. But it was a bad week for lost arts, with news that some British schools are switching entirely to digital clocks, as fewer and fewer students know how to tell time from an analog clock. It was a bad week for Harold Bornstein, President Trump's former doctor, who revealed that his office was raided last year by three burly Trump aides who carried off 35 years of the president's medical records. Bornstein also revealed that Trump dictated the glowing medical report provided to the public during the campaign. And it was a bad week for Michael Cohen, President Trump's legally embattled longtime fixer, after the National Enquirer, owned by Trump ally David Pecker, ran a cover story on Cohen's Secrets and Lies. When asked if the story was a message that the president might turn on him, Cohen replied, "What do you think?" The title of our briefing page article is "The Real Star Wars: A New Cold War is Unfolding Above Planet Earth. Will there be battles in space? What's the conflict about?" China, Russia, and the U.S. are competing for military advantage in orbit. U.S. intelligence agencies warned in February that China and Russia are developing ballistic missiles and other weapons that could be used to reliably target American satellites in the next few years. Both countries have already successfully tested space warfare technologies. In 2007, China used a missile to shoot down one of its own aging weather satellites orbiting 537 miles above the planet. Russia successfully conducted a test flight for an anti-satellite missile in 2015. The U.S. has long possessed such capabilities. In 1985, an American fighter jet successfully launched a missile into a U.S. science satellite. "Space is no longer a peaceful domain," said Deborah Lee James, Secretary of the Air Force under President Obama. "There is a real possibility that a conflict on Earth could bleed into space." Why is that? Space is strategically vital. About 1,700 active satellites currently orbit Earth, nearly half sent up by the U.S., and they become critical to the modern world's economy and daily activities. The Air Force's 33 global positioning system satellites provide timing signals used by Wall Street traders and cell phone networks, as well as powering navigation-based apps like Google Maps and Uber. Weather forecasts, video conferencing, instant credit card authorization, banking connections, and cable television are all powered by satellites. The U.S. military relies heavily on communications and surveillance satellites for virtually all of its activities, from monitoring North Korean weapons tests to coordinating troops in the field. Satellites are constantly scanning Earth to detect strikes against the U.S., looking for the distinctive plumes of a missile launch. "Space is foundational to our way of war," says General John W. Raymond, Commander of Air Force Space Command, "and it's foundational to our way of life. What would space war look like? It could take several different forms. Programmers could hack into satellites in order to dismantle or commandeer them. Lasers stationed on the ground could also be used to dazzle or blind satellite sensors, rendering them useless. In a more aggressive attack, countries could use brute force to take out rival satellites, either with ballistic missiles or by using kamikaze attack satellites to smash into targets. The Russians launched a satellite in May 2014 that appeared to be capable of offensive maneuvers, alarming U.S. intelligence. How is the U.S. responding? The military is taking steps to harden its satellites from attack. It is planning to launch redundant satellites to act as backups in case critical systems are destroyed, and developing smaller satellites that will be harder to target, as well as defensive satellites capable of detecting or even intercepting threats. Many of the details, of course, are highly classified. In March, President Trump called for the creation of a new branch of the military dedicated to space warfare. "Space is a warfighting domain, just like the land, air, and sea," Trump said. "We have an Air Force. We'll have the Space Force." Is Trump serious? It's hard to say, but he's not the first to suggest it. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld called for the creation of a Space Corps in 2001, but the idea was put on the back burner after the September 11th terrorist attacks shifted the military's focus to fighting terrorism on Earth. Right now, the U.S. Air Force Space Command is responsible for roughly 90% of the American military operations in space, employing about 36,000 people around the world. But Space Force proponents argue that space is an afterthought within an institution built to fight battles on Earth. A new co-equal Space Force could legitimize space as a vital battleground, the thinking goes, the same way the creation of the U.S. Air Force in 1947 recognized the importance of air power. But the Pentagon reportedly is opposed to the idea of adding another bureaucracy. What if war breaks out? The rules of space warfare are mostly unwritten. The Outer Space Treaty of 1967 bans countries from putting weapons of mass destruction in space, but there's no comprehensive agreement governing other kinds of space weapons or protecting civilian satellites. In 2008, the U.S. rejected a treaty submitted to the U.N. by Russia and China that would have banned weapons in space. When the European Union floated a similar proposal in 2014, it was embraced by the U.S., but China and Russia refused to sign on. The consequences of an all-out space war could be dire. In one scenario, the debris cloud created by obliterated spacecraft could set off a chain reaction that wipes out all of the satellites in orbit, ringing the Earth with space junk and rendering space unusable for generations. The challenges of war fighting in this domain are not really understood, said Todd Harrison, director of the Aerospace Security Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. We don't have any history to go on. The first space war. In 1991, Operation Desert Storm proved the vital military importance of space. Coalition forces relied on the Air Force's nascent GPS network to cross virtually uncharted tracts of desert left undefended by Iraqi commanders, who believed that no mechanized weapons or troops could cross this hostile terrain. The use of GPS navigation enabled U.S. and allied troops to outflank Saddam Hussein's military in a sweeping maneuver that became known as the Left Hook, paving the way for the swift liberation of Kuwait in a ground war lasting roughly 100 hours. Infrared warning satellites also rendered the Iraqi army's Soviet-era Scud missiles virtually useless by allowing coalition troops to accurately predict where they would land. Meanwhile, coalition artillery used GPS to devastating effect while bombarding Iraqi positions. It really was the first time that we took strategic space information and integrated it into a theater of operations, General John W. Raymond, commander of Air Force Space Command, told Popular Mechanics. There's nothing we do today. There's not a sailor, soldier, or marine that operates in their domain that isn't using space capabilities to conduct their mission. It's time to read a few of the week's best columns. We'll start with one from the U.S. Your DNA may be held against you. If you sent your DNA to a commercial genealogy site, said Susan Scuddy, it may one day be used in a criminal investigation. That's the obvious implication of last week's arrest by California police of Joseph DeAngelo, the man they believed is the infamous Golden State Killer. Investigators used a sample of the killer's DNA found at a crime scene to look for family members on GED Match, a free online service, and matched it to some of DeAngelo's relatives. Further police work led to D'Angelo. No one can dispute that solving the case would be a triumph for justice, but the landmark investigation creates real privacy concerns for the millions of people who've submitted DNA to services such as Ancestry.com and 23andMe.com. These samples contain a treasure trove of health and ancestry information about you and your family. Public defenders warn that if law enforcement agencies come to rely on DNA searches like that in the California case, it will cast a net of suspicion over hundreds of innocent people in investigations of murders, rapes, and robberies. So be forewarned. When you submit your DNA for analysis, it could one day lead to the arrest of an uncle or third cousin or you. This column comes from the Netherlands. Cyber talent follows the money. The Netherlands is hemorrhaging cybersecurity experts, said Klaas Broekhuizen. The Dutch have long been leaders in IT, particularly in counter-hacking measures. It was our security services, remember, that first alerted the U.S. to the Russian penetration of the Democratic National Committee computers in 2015. And Dutch intelligence is now a key plank in the investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 U.S. election. But we will soon lose our reputation for excellence if we don't reverse the brain drain. Already, this country has a screaming shortage of IT experts, and it's not for lack of training. Dutch graduates tend to disappear to the U.S., where they can make $300,000 a year, nearly three times what they make at home. Those who want to continue their studies go to Germany, which offers a much more generous research budget. Not enough graduates stay here to pursue PhDs in IT, which means the Netherlands is left with too few professionals. B.B. Vandenberg, who is on the government's Cybersecurity Council, says she spends all her time teaching and not enough doing research. And in such a rapidly evolving field, failing to innovate means falling behind. Vandenberg is calling for both government and private companies to invest more. It's time, she says, to sound the emergency bell. This column comes from Canada. When voters just don't care anymore. Doug Ford commands the same blind adoration as U.S. President Donald Trump, said Bob Hepburn. The leader of the Progressive Conservative Party is challenging Liberal incumbent Kathleen Wynne for the premiership of Ontario in June, and he has a lot of baggage. Like his late brother, former Toronto Mayor Rob Ford, Doug Ford is a badly flawed candidate with a long, well-reported background of bullying, abusive behavior. But just as Trump claimed that his supporters would stick by him even if he shot someone on New York's Fifth Avenue, Ford understands that his voters simply don't care what he has done or said in the past. They know about the allegations of drug dealing in the 1980s. They know he has been censured by the Toronto Integrity Commissioner for favoring businesses linked to his family firm. And as for his rants against the media, he's referred to a Toronto Star reporter as a little bitch and called journalists in general a bunch of pricks. Well, that sort of behavior probably earns him respect among his working class base. Ford has no campaign platform other than vague priorities to slash spending and cut the state's corporate tax rate, already the lowest in Canada. Still, his party is leading the race by double digits. Voters just don't care. And we'll turn now to the last word, our in-depth article, titled this week, A Changing of the border guard. Latinos now make up more than half of the U.S. Border Patrol, said journalist Brittany Mejia. For some agents of Mexican descent, balancing duty and culture in the age of Trump can be complicated. Piled into a white van driving along the U.S.-Mexico border, the young men and one woman beheld the wall and weighed just how easily it could be conquered. Isaac Antonio did not seem impressed. "That's easily climbable," the 20-year-old declared. The chaperone, a Border Patrol agent, called out from behind the wheel, "Good luck, bro. I'm sure you can, but good luck." As debate swirled, Antonio described ways that the 30-foot-high wall could be defeated, which prompted the lone woman to finally ask in faux suspicion, "Are you from Mexico?" Most of the nearly dozen participants in the El Centro Sector Border Patrol Citizens Academy were, in fact, of Mexican descent. And the mood was light as they learned about an agency they one day hoped to join. President Trump has called for hiring 5,000 more Border Patrol agents as part of his war on illegal immigration. If that happens, the academy in this Imperial Valley, California town last month offered a snapshot of what many of those likely to apply. Latinos. When the Border Patrol was established in 1924, Latinos were a tiny minority. By 1989, they made up almost 36% of the agency. Now Latinos make up a little more than 50% of the Border Patrol, according to 2016 data. This year, 10 of the 11 people taking part in the Border Patrol Citizens Academy are Latino. Being a Border Patrol agent and Latino has always been potentially fraught, with immigrants from Latin America, especially Mexico, long the focus of often vitriolic debates over illegal immigration. But with Trump reserving his most heated rhetoric for immigrants coming from Mexico and Central America, and promising massive walls to keep them out, it has rarely seemed as delicate a tightrope. Jonathan Pacheco, a nearly 10-year veteran, said being a Border Patrol agent and Latino has always guaranteed some complicated moments. "I got it initially when I first came in, the, don't you feel bad? You're catching your own people. They're just coming over here to work," he said. "A lot of the people, and I try to use good verbiage because I know that anytime anyone hears anything about, well, some of the people coming across have done illegal things, they always go back to what Trump said during his campaign." Pacheco, whose parents came from Mexico on legal visas before eventually becoming U.S. citizens, added, "I don't want to say everything he said is true or not true, but at a Border Patrol level, a lot of these people who come here are usually apprehended for the second or third time. A lot of these guys already have previous records." Salvador Zamora, acting chief patrol agent for the El Centro sector, said it's something Latino job candidates have to wrestle with. "This is something I know burns inside a lot of the Hispanic candidates. Is what do I say? What does this mean to arrest somebody from my own, maybe my parents' hometown?" Zamora said. "It's real simple. It's the law. It is right and wrong. It is not against any one race or any one ethnic group or any one particular group of people. With so many of the immigrants crossing the border illegally from Mexico and Latin America, and many border towns being majority Latino, recruiting people who are more likely to speak Spanish has always made sense," experts said. "There have been Latino agents, namely Mexican Americans, since the very beginning of Border Patrol," said Kelly Lytle Hernandez, a UCLA professor and author of Migra, A History of the U.S. Border Patrol. Of course, through the 70s, really they were a minority, but they were actively recruited as early as the 1920s, for their language abilities in particular. The majority The majority of trainees in the El Centro Border Patrol Academy this year grew up near the border. Unlike many young Latinos in urban and often more liberal areas, they refer to those in the country illegally simply as illegals. Some trainees have family members who work for the Border Patrol. Manuel Trujillo has a stepfather in the Border Patrol. 18-year-old Eduardo Segura's parents pushed him to follow in the footsteps of his older sister, who is an agent. One of Isaac Antonio's aunts is in the Border Patrol. Antonio's maternal grandparents are from Mexico. On his father's side, his grandfather is from the Philippines and his grandmother from Mexico. At times, Antonio has found himself arguing with friends over his desire to join the Border Patrol. Those debates have become more common and intense since Trump's election. Antonio, who hails from El Centro, said friends have told him they can't believe he wants to arrest his own people. He said that he responds by saying, "I'm protecting my people. My people are here." But he said it can be complicated. Last year, he spotted two immigrants jumping over a border fence. When a Border Patrol agent headed in their direction, Antonio said one of his friends shouted a warning in Spanish. In that moment, Antonio said he remembered thinking, "Run." "I know sometimes most of them just want to come over here for a better future," he said. But Antonio said he dreams of being a Border Patrol agent, and there's no doubt that he would do his job. You do arrest people who are like, "What if that was my uncle?" "If it was my uncle," he said before pausing, "I would arrest him. But I wouldn't be able to, like, physically do it. I would have another agent do it." Jose Avalos, one of the trainees, would not have been born in the U.S. had his mother, Fanny Posada, not crossed the border illegally in 1987. She left Mexico to provide for her young family. Posada left Avalos' older brother with her mother and hopped a bus from Mexico City to Tijuana. After that, she trekked through the desert for hours with 40 other people, led by a guide who would get paid by an aunt if he got Posada into California. When he saw car lights approaching, the guide panicked and ran down a hill, leaving Posada and others to fend for themselves. Posada said she has vivid recollections of a helicopter flying overhead and a Border Patrol agent with a gun out of his holster in the distance. Posada hid in a bush until everything went quiet. Eventually, she made it to a store in California, and the owner called the number written on Posada's arm for her aunt to come get her. She obtained a work permit her first year in the U.S. after laboring in a Lodi vineyard. 14 years later, in 2001, Posada applied to join the Border Patrol. She had been encouraged by her next-door neighbor, who was an agent. Her neighbor pushed her to get her GED and her residency. When Posada didn't have the money to get her citizenship, the agent wrote her a check. "You deserve this. Your kids deserve this," he told her. The agent, now retired, declined to be interviewed. Posada said the fact that she had been born in Mexico influenced a question she was asked during her interview with the Border Patrol. The agent asked how they could be sure that she wouldn't let immigrants go free. "You're paying me, and I have to do my job," Posada said as she responded. "But I'm not going to be mean to them, and I'm going to try and tell them how they can try legally. That I will try to share with them, because I know they're nice people. They're just looking for employment. Now, if I found someone with drugs, I probably wouldn't be that nice." In the end, Posada did not join the Border Patrol because she had no one to watch her children while she attended the academy. Instead, she began working for the city of Brawley, where she has been for 17 years. In September, Avalos, 28, applied to become an agent. He said he wanted a job that could provide a good life for his wife and himself. Like his mother, he said that he was inspired by their neighbors, the Border Patrol agent. He has taken the polygraph test and hopes that Trump's pledge to hire more agents means he'll be able to start his career soon. People might say, oh, you don't care about your culture, Avalos said. I love everything about my culture, but I was born here and I consider myself American. On a Saturday last month, trainees stood on a drag road in Calexico under a gloomy sky. The traffic in the much larger Mexican city of Mexicali was visible through an 18-foot bollard-style fence. They formed a semicircle around Agent Juan Gonzalez as he pointed out their footprint patterns in the dirt, identifying them as honeycomb or waffle iron. Those footprints can help agents locate people who jumped the fence by calling in the pattern over the radio to the agent on the next drag road. Michael Araujo, one of the trainees, has uncles who crossed illegally and later fixed their papers. The father of a close friend was deported and lives on the Mexican side of the border, where the family visits him every other weekend. I know how much that's a struggle, and I feel bad for those situations where the family is separated, 19-year-old Araujo said. For most people, when you sign up for this, you realize you're most likely not allowing someone to maybe visit their family. Maybe they already have family here. It's a major conflict internally, but it has to be done. Like many other trainees, Araujo said a major reason for wanting to join the Border Patrol is a simple one. It's a job in a county with the second highest unemployment rate statewide at 17%. The Border Patrol is one of the top employers in Imperial City. On an agent salary here in Imperial Value, you'll be upper middle class, Gonzalez told the group. Everyone's kind of interested if you're from around here, Araujo said. They know it's one of the few places you can get a good job. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the Los Angeles Times. Read one of the obituaries that brings back some childhood memories for me. The jazz man who created Schoolhouse Rock, Bob Duro, 1923 to 2018. Bob Duro was struggling to eke out a living as a jazz musician in the early 1970s when an ad executive came up to him with an unusual request. Could the singer and pianist write some songs to help children memorize multiplication tables? The original idea was to make a record and workbook, but when Duro pumped out snappy numbers like 3 is a magic number and My Hero Zero, the project grew into a series of animated shorts that ABC inserted between Saturday morning cartoons. The Schoolhouse Rock series moved on from math to civics, science, and parts of speech, and helped educate a whole generation of kids. While Duro had jammed with jazz greats, including Miles Davis, Dizzy Gillespie, and Charlie Parker, he knew he'd be remembered for Schoolhouse Rock. I'm cool with it being the first thing people see in my obituary, he said. The son of a salesman and a homemaker, Duro grew up in rural Arkansas and Texas, said the Washington Post. He showed musical talent early, and by his teens, he was playing piano, clarinet, and saxophone. His jazz career would be anything but conventional, said the Los Angeles Times. After serving as a composer in the Army Band during World War II, he went on to work as a music director for Sugar Ray Robinson during the boxer's short-lived show business career, and as an accompanist to beat poet Allen Ginsberg and acerbic comedian Lenny Bruce. Duro was also one of the few vocalists to record with Davis. He co-wrote and sang on Davis' Rye 1962 ditty, Blue Christmas, to whom it may concern. Well connected in the music world, Duro recruited a high-end assortment of talent for Schoolhouse Rock, said the New York Times. Respected jazz artists like Blossom Dearie, Dave Frischberg, and Jack Sheldon all contributed. The last singing Fishberg's I'm Just a Bill about the workings of Congress. For the rest of his career, it was not uncommon for him to be playing a jazz set and have someone call for a Schoolhouse Rock tune, a request he always gladly indulged. What you'll notice is each one of them is musically brilliant, said Steve Berger, Duro's longtime guitarist. He never wrote down to the kids. He always brought them up. We'll get a couple of the health and science pieces this week. The first is air pollution worsening in U.S. cities. More than 40% of Americans are breathing heavily polluted air, increasing their risk for lung cancer, asthma, heart problems, and other health issues. That's the worrisome conclusion of the American Lung Association's latest annual State of the Air report, which has been tracking air quality across the U.S. for 19 years. The report concluded that 133.9 million Americans lived in areas that get an F for air pollution in 2016, up from 125 million in 2015. Researchers focused on the two most common outdoor air pollutants, ozone and particles. Ozone is an odorless toxic gas that occurs naturally in the upper atmosphere, but it can also form at ground levels when industrial pollutants react with heat and sunlight. Particle pollution includes dust, fumes, soot, smoke, and aerosols. The report found that although particle pollution levels are still falling, a long-term trend attributed to the 1970 Clean Air Act, ozone levels are increasing, likely thanks to rising temperatures. In 2016, the second hottest year on record, there was a sharp spike in the number of days with high ozone levels, reports CSMonitor.com. Even with the continued improvements in particle levels, says the ALA's Janice Nolan, we're seeing the evidence of the challenge of climate change. Ozone exposure increases the risk of lung cancer, cardiovascular disease, asthma attacks, and developmental harm. Los Angeles has the highest ozone levels in the country. Other cities with high levels include Sacramento, Phoenix, and New York City. When hominins straightened up. At what point did early humans switch from ape-like shuffling to walking upright? Scientists have long puzzled over that question, and new research suggests it was much earlier than previously thought. Evolutionary anthropologists at the University of Arizona examined footprints discovered in Laetoli, Tanzania, that were made by human ancestors about 3.6 million years ago. Analysis shows that the heel and toe impressions of the ancient footprints closely match those made by modern humans walking upright rather than bent over. That suggests early human ancestors lost their ape-like shuffle and adopted a straight-legged gait long before big-brained members of the Homo genus emerged about 2.5 million years ago. While there may have been some nuanced differences, study author David Reichlin tells ScienceDaily.com, these hominins probably looked like us when they walked. Moving in a crouched position requires more energy than walking with a vertical torso and long stride. Scientists believe our early ancestors adjusted their gait because the changing climate forced them to cover greater distances to find food. On the Talking Points page now, incels, I-N-C-E-L-S, the celibate men who hate women. After every terrorist mass murder in the West, people's first reaction is always the same, said Gary Young in TheGuardian.com. It must be a Muslim. But the man charged with driving a van along a Toronto sidewalk last week, killing 8 women and 2 men, appears to have been inspired not by religion, but by toxic masculinity. Alex Manassian, 25, posted a Facebook message before the attack, hailing the incel movement, an online community of involuntarily celibate men that sprang up in 2016. Incels hate women for denying them the sex they believe is rightfully theirs. They call other people normies. Attractive women are Stacies. Sexually successful men are Chads. And revere Elliot Rodger, the student who in 2014 killed 6 people in Isla Vista, California, as revenge for his failure to find a girlfriend. The incel rebellion has already begun, Manassian wrote on Facebook. All hail supreme gentleman Elliot Rodger. The incel movement shows where hate speech can lead, said Aditi Natasha Keeney in WashingtonPost.com. The men in it believe there's no unattractive and weird, believe they're so unattractive and weird, they'll never have sex, and view women's disinterest in them as a form of systemic persecution. Believe it or not, there are tens of thousands of those disaffected young men spewing their misogyny online, said Navneet Along in TheWeek.com. Before the internet, these men may have smoldered in isolation or eventually grown out of their juvenile resentments. But sites such as Reddit and 4chan enable them to amplify their feeling of legitimacy and egg one another on to punish women. In this case, with tragic consequences. Incels are just one subset of anti-woman communities online, said Jessica Valenti in the New York Times. The manosphere also includes men's rights activists who think men are oppressed and pickup artists who discuss how to manipulate women into having sex. What all these movements share is an organized hatred of women who do not submit to men's needs and demands. Feminists have long warned about the propensity of these hate groups for real-life violence, but we've largely been ignored. That's because sexism and misogyny are still considered normal in our society rather than deviant. And until that changes, far too many men will assault, rape, and murder women. Not every attack is preventable, but the misogyny that drives them is. Bill Cosby, hashtag MeToo's first conviction. It'll go down as the first conviction of the MeToo era, said Anna North in Vox.com. In a verdict that caused shrieks of exultation, a jury in Norristown, Pennsylvania, last week found Bill Cosby guilty of drugging and sexually assaulting a woman named Andrea Constand in 2004. Cosby, who faces up to 30 years in prison, probably thought he'd escape justice after his first trial ended last summer with a hung jury. But that was before a string of explosive allegations against rich and powerful men sparked a cultural reckoning around sexual harassment and assault. His conviction suggests the Me Too movement has made it easier for survivors to get justice. We are truly entering a new era, said Maria Paranitis in the Philadelphia Inquirer. Harvey Weinstein and men like him had better be afraid, very afraid. Sorry, but I doubt the conviction marks a turning point, said Christina Cauterucci in Slate.com. Cosby was a singular case, a shameless serial sexual abuser accused of assaulting at least 58 women. Most of those allegations were rendered moot by statutes of limitations, but the retrial judge took the unusual step of allowing 5 women to testify, and they laid bare Cosby's sickening modus operandi. Jurors were even shown testimony from a 2005 deposition in which Cosby admitted using sedatives to coax women into sexual submission. Crimes of sexual violence remain prohibitively difficult to prosecute, said Angelina Chapin in HuffingtonPost.com. Most judges and jurors are predisposed to believe the defendant, especially when the accuser doesn't fight, flee, and immediately report the abuse. Most cases become, he said, she said, affairs, with no witnesses. Sadly, Cosby's conviction won't change a legal culture that treats complainants as if they were the ones on trial. Cosby deserves whatever sentence he gets for what he did to Constan, said Wesley Morris in the New York Times. But for the black folks like me who grew up watching The Cosby Show, the comedian's fall from grace is deeply disorienting. Cosby's character, Cliff Huxtable, was America's dad, an icon for black Americans. Wise, witty, educated, and affluent, he made blackness palatable to a country historically conditioned to think the worst of our race. Yet now we know that Cosby used his wealth and fame to become the very stereotype that Huxtable did so much to dispel, the black predator. Cosby told lots of jokes. That was his sickest one. And a couple of short notes. Since 2012, Immigration and Customs Enforcement has released more than 1,480 people from custody after discovering they were U.S. citizens. In one case, a U.S. citizen was held in detention for 1,273 days after being wrongfully taken into custody by ICE. The Senate recently confirmed President Trump's 15th appeals court nominee, giving him more appointments than the last five presidents at this stage. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell helped shape this conservative realignment by blocking dozens of then-President Obama's judicial nominees. And we'll finish with a quote from Theodore Roosevelt. He says, "The poorest way to face life is to face it with a sneer." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.